The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll share with you information from various medical sources. People's Pharmacy, Joe and Teresa Graydon, King Features Syndicate. How effective is the Shingrix vaccine? That's spelled S-H-I-N-G-R-I-X. Question. My older brother suffered from long-lasting pain after shingles. This is something my late mother experienced as well. Consequently, I decided to go ahead and get the Shingrix vaccine. For most people, it seems the side effects of the vaccine are likely to be less troubling than the suffering resulting from shingles. Answer. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that Shingrix vaccine is about 97% effective in people 50 to 69 years old. Effectiveness drops a bit in people over 70 to about 91%. That's still impressive. Protection remains high for at least 4 years after the vaccination. Shingles is a painful rash caused by the virus that causes chickenpox. Sometimes after the rash fades, the patient is left with excruciating nerve pain and tenderness in that area of the skin. That complication is called postherpetic neuralgia. It can be extremely hard to treat. Two doses of Shingrix were 91% effective in preventing the development of postherpetic neuralgia, the lasting pain your brother has suffered. Question. My 13-year-old son has attention deficit disorder. He has been on Actavis's generic Concerta, ORS system with excellent results. He has made the honor roll and earned straight A's for 4 years running. Last month, the pharmacy switched to a different generic. He's now failing math and is symptomatic. I know Actavis was purchased by Teva. I contacted Teva and was told Actavis 27 milligrams was on back order. No pharmacies in our region have any. Do you know of an equivalent generic? Or could my son switch to regular methylphenidate tablets and take them breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Answer. The Osmotic Relief Oral System, or OROS, was approved for Concerta in 2000 and allows for convenient once-daily dosing. And that's cited in CNS Drugs, November 2014. Actavis was selling this under an authorized generic agreement with Janssen, the original maker of Concerta. However, that agreement lapsed at the end of last year. Another generic supplier, Teva Pharmaceutical Industries, should be shipping authorized generic methylphenidate early in 2009. Brand name Concerta is available, though the cost could be around $350 a month. From the Wall Street Journal, Health and Wellness, a rush to offer stroke procedure. Jacques Hayes, a Detroit area construction worker, recently fell in his apartment. A visitor heard the thud in the next room, then saw Mr. Hayes struggle to walk and talk, falling a second time. So the friend called 911. Mr. Hayes was fortunate to be taken to Detroit's Henry Ford Hospital, which is among a quickly growing number of U.S. hospitals offering a revolutionary stroke procedure known as thrombectomy, in which a blood clot is quickly removed before a patient suffers lasting damage or death. Hospitals are rushing to offer the procedure after groundbreaking research has concluded. The sooner the thrombectomy, the better the chances a severe stroke patient will recover and, in many cases, recuperate enough to live independently. At Henry Ford, doctors had heard the paramedics' speculation that perhaps Mr. Hayes had been drinking. However, Henry Ford's medical personnel pinpointed the diagnosis with an advanced scan known as a CT angiogram. Right away, the team saw a blockage in his right middle cerebral artery, a serious stroke. He got a clot-dissolving drug at 10:09 a.m. He was wheeled into the angiography suite, and a catheter was inserted into an artery at 10:56 a.m. Just over 20 minutes later, the doctors had pulled out the clot. During rounds the next morning, Mr. Hayes was able to make a thumbs-up sign and answer to yes or no questions. In the week since, his speech is still halting, but he is able to walk and move freely. Stephen A. Mayer, Henry Ford's chairman of neurology, estimates that without the thrombectomy, two-thirds of Mr. Hayes' brain tissue on one side of his brain would have died, rendering him paralyzed on one side. I'm shocked at how well he's doing, Dr. Mayer says. He's a super save. Dramatic results are putting pressure on hospitals, big and small, to offer the new procedure, leading to better outcomes as well as financial rewards. Leading stroke doctors concluded in a February 2016 analysis in the medical journal Lancet that 38 out of 100 patients treated with thrombectomy will have a less disabled outcome than with standard care. Also, they said that 20 more will achieve functional independence. Some leading hospitals, such as the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and Atlanta's Grady Memorial Hospital in the U.S. and others in Europe, were early to do thrombectomies. Nationally, the number of such clot removal treatments has jumped to an estimated 27,000 cases in the year ended in June 2018, up from 13,000 a year earlier. According to the medical data company Definitive Healthcare, and yet elsewhere, use of less clear CT scan technology at many hospitals remains a hurdle, as do regional ambulance systems that often take patients to hospitals that aren't able to do the procedure. Only about 15% of the patients who need a thrombectomy actually get one, leading stroke doctors say. Most hospitals calling themselves primary stroke centers aren't capable of doing a thrombectomy. A medical certification group that accredits stroke hospitals, the Joint Commission, based in Chicago's suburbs, has started approving a new type of hospital called a thrombectomy-capable stroke center. These are hospitals that don't necessarily perform enough volumes of neurosurgery or treatment of brain hemorrhages to qualify for higher comprehensive stroke center status, but they're able to offer thrombectomies. The original idea was to make the life-saving technique available in underserved, often rural areas, but as more hospitals get on board, it hasn't necessarily been good for public health, some prominent stroke doctors say. Multiple studies show that higher volumes of cases generally produce the best outcomes, with doctors and their teams gaining more experience and proficiency. And yet, many of the newly designated hospitals are within just 2 to 10 miles of an existing comprehensive stroke center, potentially leading to lower volumes at individual stroke hospitals. The Joint Commission is certifying hospitals too close to each other, says Dr. Adam Arthur, president of the Society of Neurointerventional Surgery, which represents doctors who perform thrombectomies. This over-certification is not in the best interests of stroke patients. The Joint Commission said, "We are aware of these concerns and are analyzing travel times between the two types of centers." Early in his career as a stroke doctor, Dr. Mayer saw patients with stroke symptoms who waited hours without treatment. Some had a fixed gaze or were half paralyzed, others couldn't speak, or had abnormally dilated pupils caused by pressure in the brain. Despite these telltale signs of stroke, their initial diagnosis involved inconclusive CT scan technology, resulting in patients waiting too long to be treated. People would sit there with their brain burning, says Dr. Mayer. Until recently, a new stroke patient would only get a CT scan upon arrival to rule out the possibility of a brain hemorrhage, so doctors could safely administer a clot-dissolving drug. It is quickly becoming standard of comprehensive stroke centers, which do thrombectomies, for stroke patients to get a more precise CT angiogram, thanks partly to the work of Dr. Mayer at Henry Ford. Getting that CT angiogram up front tells you it's a stroke, Dr. Mayer says. As Henry Ford used the new imaging technology, the number of clot retrieval cases grew, and the two thrombectomy-capable doctors were soon overwhelmed with cases. So Dr. Mayer brought in another stroke doctor. He also met with leadership at Henry Ford's four satellite hospitals and four freestanding emergency departments, winning converts. Now everyone is screened, says Alex B. Chebble, the newest stroke doctor at Henry Ford. We don't miss anybody. Even so, at many hospitals, it's currently not ubiquitous standard of care to be getting a CT angiogram at the same time as the initial CT, says John DeLatta, chairman of emergency medicine at Henry Ford. The initial cost of building a thrombectomy suite is about $2.5 million, and the thrombectomy specialist teams can be upward of another $600,000 annually, according to medical industry documents. But reimbursement from Medicare can average $37,000 per case at a typical big city hospital like Henry Ford, compared with an average cost of $26,000 a case. So the procedure can be profitable for hospitals over time. When Dr. Mayer became the head neurologist at Henry Ford, he recalls, I saw an empty canvas. I told hospital leadership, stroke is poised for explosive growth. From the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, cold sores, a lifelong virus. Selling the family home and downsizing has brought about considerable stress in recent months, and that stress brought about a side effect you weren't expecting. A few cold sore flare-ups. After years with no problems, these lingering sores are frustrating. Is there anything you can do? Trigger alert. A cold sore is a small, fluid-filled blister, or more often a group of blisters that typically develops on or around the lips. These blisters quickly dry out and form a scab a day or two before an outbreak occurs. You may experience a burning, itching, or tingling sensation on the area of skin where the sore will eventually appear. Cold sores are caused by the herpes simplex virus, which is typically passed from skin-to-skin contact. Once you're exposed to the virus, it's present in your body for life. After the initial infection, the virus will travel to your nerves, where it remains dormant but may awaken periodically. Often, there's a trigger that causes the virus to wake up, which leads to the development of cold sores. Common triggers include stress, illness such as a cold or influenza, exposure to sunlight, wind, or other elements, a cut or other injury to the skin, changes in the immune system, hormonal changes such as those associated with menstruation. Finding relief. Most cold sores will heal on their own within a couple of weeks. If the discomfort bothers you, a non-prescription pain reliever such as Tylenol or others, or ibuprofen like Advil, Motrin, IB, others may help. Non-prescription cold sore gels or ointments containing ingredients such as benzocaine, lidocaine, or benzyl alcohol can also relieve symptoms. Cool compress or sucking on ice chips may help minimize any burning or itch. You may also want to cut back on foods that irritate a sore, including foods that are salty or spicy, as well as acidic foods such as tomatoes and citrus fruits. Applying petroleum jelly to the sore and surrounding skin can help reduce any dryness and cracking. To reduce the duration of cold sores as well as help relieve symptoms, the non-prescription antiviral cream Abreva may be worth a try. Abreva is most effective if used when you first notice tingling or other early symptoms that indicate a cold sore is forming. However, the effect of the drug is limited, only reducing the duration of symptoms by a matter of hours when treatment is recommended. If cold sores persist for longer than 2 weeks or keep returning, see your primary doctor or dermatologist for an evaluation. Your doctor may recommend treatment with an antiviral medication. These include acyclovir or Zovirax or pencyclovir denivir, creams that are applied directly to the sore multiple times a day, or drugs such as acyclovir valacyclovir, which is Valtrex, or famciclovir, which may be taken by mouth within the first few days of an outbreak. While topical antivirals reduce the duration of symptoms by less than a day, oral antivirals may take up to 1 or 2 days off the duration of the outbreak. Talk to your doctor about treatment if you have eczema, atopic dermatitis, or a weakened immune system, as you may be prone to more serious infections and complications. Also, see your doctor for treatment if any cold sores develop near your eyes or at the tip of your nose. If you tend to get cold sores often, generally more than 9 times a year, your doctor may recommend a daily antiviral medication for major outbreaks that aren't helped by other drugs. An intravenous antiviral medication may be recommended. Research is ongoing into a class of antiviral drugs known as helicase primase inhibitors, which may prove to be more effective than existing antivirals at reducing the frequency and severity of outbreaks, prevent spread, and reduce outbreaks. If you have an active cold sore, take care to reduce the likelihood of it spreading to other parts of the body and to others. To do so, avoid touching the sore, wash your hands if you do, kissing as well as other intimate contact with the affected area, sharing personal items including towels, lip balms, or razors, or sharing foods and beverages. To protect your skin and reduce the likelihood of further flare-ups, use a lip balm that contains a broad-spectrum sunscreen. Stress-relieving techniques also may help reduce outbreaks. Second opinion. Question. Among the discomforts of having a colonoscopy, the worst for me is drinking the large amount of laxative solution in preparation. Are there ways to avoid this? Answer. Colonoscopy can be a life-saving screening test for colon cancer. However, one often uncomfortable aspect is that the large intestine needs to be empty and clean in order for the procedure to be most effective. There's no way to avoid some type of bowel cleansing product to make this happen. Until fairly recently, the main bowel prep product involved drinking 2 to 4 liters or 64 to 128 ounces of somewhat salty tasting fluid over a short time. However, several new products have been developed in the past decade that involve drinking significantly less fluid. Prepopic, PREPOPIK, comes in a 10-ounce dose, which you drink along with 64 ounces of a clear liquid of your choice. Suprep comes in a 12-ounce dose, which you drink along with 84 ounces of a clear liquid. And Plenview, the latest product, comes in a 32-ounce dose, which you drink in addition to at least 32 ounces of a clear liquid. There's also a non-prescription option that involves using polyethylene glycol or Miralax, followed by an electrolyte-containing drink such as Gatorade. However, it doesn't work as effectively as prescription preparations, and depending on your medication coverage, it might actually cost more. With any colon prep laxative, a split dose is often recommended. This involves drinking just half of the laxative in one sitting, with the other half taken later in the day or in the morning of the procedure. This can help make even high-volume bowel prep solutions more tolerable. Downsides of the low-volume bowel prep solutions are that they aren't recommended for those with heart, kidney, or liver disease. This may prevent many older adults from using them. In addition, low-volume solutions are more expensive. It's important to know that whatever prep you do, it will involve a significant amount of fluid, which drives the cleaning out process. No matter what you have to drink, you can make it more tolerable by chilling the drink, drinking through a straw or plugging your nose, adding powdered flavor, avoid green or red powders. The coloring can make visualization difficult or be interpreted as blood during a colonoscopy. And finally, sucking on a lemon or hard candy or chewing gum between glasses. Question. My granddaughter often seems to sneeze when she steps into the sun. Is this from an allergy? Answer. This phenomena, commonly called a sun sneeze, is technically known as either photic sneeze reflex or an autosomal dominant compelling helio-ophthalmic outburst, which is A-C-H-O-O, achoo. syndrome. It's not linked to allergies, although there is some common ground on how the sneezes may occur. Typically, a sneeze occurs because of irritation in the nose, such as from dust or pollen. The irritation fires trigeminal nerve, the main cranial nerve that carries sensation from your face to the brain, to trigger the sneeze. Although the cause of sun sneezing isn't fully understood, the theory is it involves the optic nerve, which senses changes in light. When you step out of a dark room into the light, your pupils constrict. This reflex is triggered by the optic nerve. It's thought that rapid triggering may give the same sensation as an irritation in the nose, causing the same effect on the trigeminal nerve. Sun sneezing is common, affecting 11 to 35% of people. While harmless on its own, sun sneezing could potentially cause issues with driving, such as with emerging from a road tunnel on a bright day. Shielding your eyes with sunglasses or your car's visor may help. Colorectal cancer. Managing recurrence risk. The rate of colorectal cancer survivor 5 years after initial diagnosis has been on the rise, but with survival comes a new risk, that of colorectal cancer recurrence. Colorectal cancer recurrence within 5 years after the treatment is in the range of 7 to 42%, depending on the stage of the cancer. The risk of cancer recurrence is understandably a common source of worry and anxiety for many who have had this cancer. Although the risk of recurrence can't be entirely eliminated, people and their doctors can take steps to reduce risk and to increase the chances that a recurrence is detected early if it happens. Cancer surveillance. The exact details of programs for surveillance are somewhat controversial and may vary based on your doctor's recommendations. In general, Mayo Clinic cancer doctors follow three main steps, which include, number one, follow-up colonoscopy. After surgery to remove a colon or rectal cancer, a follow-up colonoscopy is generally performed 1 year later. If that result is normal, subsequent follow-ups intervals of 3 to 5 years are often recommended, depending on the results. There are a number of factors that may result in a modified schedule. Due to the potential for recurrence in people treated for rectal cancer, periodic examination of the rectum may be warranted, in addition to the colonoscopy recommendations above. Blood tests for carcinoembryonic antigen, or CEA. Elevated CEA levels in blood can be a sign of several cancers, including colorectal cancer. After successful removal of colorectal cancer, CEA levels should return to a more normal level, typically within about 6 weeks. The test looks for any suspicious rise in CEA levels, which may be a sign of returning cancer. Testing for CEA is generally performed every 3 to 6 months for 2 years, then every 6 months for 3 additional years. Computerized tomography, or CT scans. If the cancer was aggressive or advanced, some sort of imaging, such as a CT scan of your chest, abdomen, and pelvis, may be done at least annually for at least 3 years to look for signs of returning cancer. These guidelines continuously evolve and may include taking a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis every 6 to 12 months for colon and rectal cancers. Since rectal cancers often spread to the lungs, a CT chest scan may be done at least every 6 months for the first 2 or 3 years, along with a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis, and is done at least annually for colon cancers. Recurrence prevention. There's no certain way to stop cancer from recurring. However, there are steps thought to specifically reduce colorectal cancer risk, including maintaining a healthy weight. There's increasing evidence that being overweight or obese increases the risk of colorectal cancer recurrence. Work with your doctor to develop a plan to lose weight if you're overweight, including your plan, advice and counseling on healthy eating, portion control and exercise. Eating a healthy diet. Red and processed meats, refined and heavily processed grains, and a high intake of sugar are associated with colorectal cancer recurrence. Eliminate or greatly reduce these foods and adopt a diet with a foundation of minimally processed plant foods such as fruits, vegetables, beans, nuts, and whole grains. To that foundation, add lean protein sources and consume predominantly healthy fats such as olive oil. Moderate coffee consumption is okay. Moderate coffee consumption is okay too, and may even provide a slight risk reduction benefit. In particular, consuming at least a couple of servings weekly of tree nuts, such as almonds and walnuts, has been associated with significant reductions in the risk of recurrence and the risk of death of colorectal cancer. Adopting a high-fiber diet. In a recent 8-year study, increasing dietary fiber after a colorectal cancer diagnosis reduced the risk of dying of the disease by 18% for every 5 grams of increase in daily fiber intake. Whole grams appeared to provide the most benefit. Taking low-dose aspirin. Several studies with extended follow-up have shown that daily and prolonged intake of aspirin appears to play a protective role against developing colorectal cancer and may also reduce recurrence of polyps and cancer within the colon and rectum. In people who are at low risk of developing stomach bleeding from aspirin, low-dose aspirin is often recommended for cancer prevention for those 50 to 69 who have at least a 10-year life expectancy. Discuss with your doctor what's best for you. And finally, stopping smoking. Research shows that long-term cigarette smoking is a risk factor for colorectal polyps and cancer. Furthermore, smoking may be associated with worse cancer-related outcomes in people who have had colorectal cancer. Get moving. A sedentary lifestyle increases cancer risk in general. Getting 30 to 60 minutes of moderately intense exercise most days is an important part of any plan to prevent cancer and cancer recurrence. This may not be realistic at first if you are fatigued, are deconditioned, or have side effects of cancer treatment. Still, ask for help in developing an exercise plan that gradually increases your fitness in a sustainable way. Exercise often contributes to better physical function, reduced fatigue, and improved quality of life in people who have had cancer. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.